Hello, friends. Welcome to Culture Cryptids. We're back for another episode exploring the super spooky and always fun world of urban legends.
Yeah, two Urban Legends episodes in a row.
Yeah, you guys are either lucking out or we're lazy. One of the two, you can figure it out for yourself.
Don't think it's a lazy thing. I just think we both really like Urban Legends.
That's more true. And you can only do like so much research for a big episode at a time. So it helps to kind of have some of these spread in there.
I think
Anyway.
I love that you say like so much research for big episodes whenever the amount of research that you did for this one, the amount of research you do for any of our Urban Legends episodes, I think qualifies as a quote unquote big episode.
Well, I have fewer pages for this one of notes than
Oh,
I did for the
okay.
last one, but that doesn't really say anything. Because I think last week I was at 8. I think this week we're only at 6. So,
Oh, he really trimmed it
yeah,
down
I really
there.
trimmed the fat off. Trimmed the fat off. My college English professors would be proud. Maybe, who knows? They're probably not.
Oh, who cares?
So
Academia
that's.
is a joke.
You know, it is. As I always say, that I am a recovering academic because I left that hellhole. But I still really love research. So go figure. You know, everyone's got their vices, and that's mine.
It's that neurodivergent urge to learn as much as you can. That's what it is.
It's true. It's
Yeah.
so true. I can't tell you my partner's phone number, but I can sure tell you all of the details about some random movie from the 70s. I know all of that, but you know, welcome to my life.
Perfect, perfect.
Winning, winning. So, as you might have noticed, it is in fact February, and you know what that means.
Love is in the air.
Sometimes, occasionally. Yeah, it's love-ish, you know, we'll say.
Well, of course, we're going to take love and we're going to spin it on its head and do it the way that we do it, like we've done before.
It's true.
But before we get into that, I think introductions are in order.
Fair enough.
And if you are joining us for the first time or not, if you've forgotten who I am, because we all forget things, I'm JD, and I never had to worry about a hook hand murder because I'm too tall for funny business in a car.
Oh, you are very tall. I feel like that would be awkward. Like,
Yeah.
not even the back of a Volkswagen.
No, I had
That
like
is a joke for the Gen Xers in our audience right there.
not in my Toyota Corolla hatchback that I had in high school, not at all. No.
Oh no. I was too country. I had a blazer for a while.
Oh, nice.
I did. And I am your other co-host, in case you've forgotten or you're here for the first time. Welcome. I'm Corey. And yeah, the call might be coming from inside the house, and that's pretty scary. But let's be honest, I'm a millennial, so I'm not going to pick up anyway because there's
No.
nothing scarier than a ringing phone.
Just text me, bro. Just text me.
So yeah, it's February. We're here to talk about love and other horrifying things. Speaking of love and other things, like since we're big movie people, I have to ask you this vaguely, possibly embarrassing question, and I'm very excited about the answer.
You
What
say
is
that
it?
now,
I know,
but
I'm so excited. What is a movie that you found to be romantic or sexy that was definitely not intended to be sexy?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the live action one, the first one.
The first one
Yeah.
specifically?
Yeah. Specifically the first one or both of them. Like, okay. Let me set the scene. I was obsessed. Are you okay?
Continue.
I was obsessed with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when I was a kid, and specifically with Donatello, because of course I was, because I am a gay, and it purple and a bow staff and the smart one. And seeing them in live action, like actually like in real life, and seeing Donatello in real life. And I think wasn't Donatello voiced by Corey Feldman? I'm fairly certain, right?
It was one of the Corey's,
Yeah,
yes, most
so like
definitely.
that just like amped it up even more. I mean, I can't say it was sexy because I think I was too young to understand what sexy was, but
But you
adult
were
me
into
looking, I was into it,
the
yeah.
turtles. So this was
Imagine.
your like scaly awakening.
Yeah, not my Furry Awakening, because no, we all no, know my Furry Awakening, it was Robin Hood, Disney's Robin Hood.
Yeah, the Disney animated Robin Hood was, there's two types of people. Those who Furry Awakening was the Disney's Robin Hood, and those whose Furry Awakening was the Lion King. Like, I don't know which one you are, where you fall on the spectrum, but.
Oh, it's Robin Hood. That fox was sexy. I've said that numerous times. That fox was sexy.
You have. Said this numerous times. All right.
What about you? What is a movie that you found sexy that was not intentionally sexy?
Gosh. So this is the thing, is I threw this question out here and I did not have a prepared response for it, because I knew yours was going to be funnier no matter what.
Because I'm disturbed. That's why.
it's just maybe a little. That's what it is. But I, often enjoy all the stories about your sexual awakening, because they're usually more entertaining than mine. I'm trying to think. Sexy movies. They weren't supposed to be sexy. Because I can't say any of the ones that I'm like, oh, that's real obvious. Because I think that was intended to be sexy. Like, I feel like Labyrinth was intended to be sexy. And again, that movie was very confusing for me and my budding sexuality, let me tell you right now.
I don't know. I think a case could be made for that one. Like, I definitely, I think that there was somebody who was like, this is going to be sexy, but I think, but the overall production probably was not aware of that.
No, probably not. Yeah. So probably Labyrinth was that movie for me that I was like, this is very sexy. There's a lot of, okay, moments for me. It's just one of those movies where people look at me and go, this must have been very confusing for you growing up. And yes it was. But you can say that about a lot of Muppet movies, and I don't know what that says about me as a person.
You were one of those kids who was like, leave the baby, stay with him, right? I mean, I was too.
Oh, like, 100%. 100%. Like, it's just a baby. Babies are terrible.
Well, what are we gonna, like, how are we taking love and putting our spin on it this time? Because we've done bad breakups.
Yes.
We've done the stalker trope, like the stalker with a crush. What are we doing this time?
This time, we're going to deep dive into some sex and love urban legends. More heavy on the kind of creepy sex and dating side of things, though, of course.
Taking a little trip down some Lover's Lane legends.
Yes, we are. Actually.
Okay. Well, I know you've got one queued up ready to go with all of your 6 pages of research. How about you start us off? What do you want to tell me about?
So I figured actually start off, speaking of babies, let's talk about some babies starting off here.
Gross.
I
children.
Well, so speaking of gross and children, are you aware, JD, that we are in the middle of a teen pregnancy crisis, right?
Well, I feel like we always are.
Right, we're always in the middle of it. Well, and this is the thing, like the youths are out of control, JD. They're just completely out of control.
Trust me, I know. I have teenagers in my life.
You do. I've seen you, I've seen you have to parent teenagers before. It's kind of delightful. But speaking of teens and babies, I'm going to tell you the story about the Pregnancy Pact. And I don't know if you're familiar with this one at all.
Vaguely?
Okay. There is a really terrible Lifetime movie, which we will touch on as we go on through. So here is the story. In 2008, the small town of Gloucestershire, Massachusetts, found themselves in the middle of an unusual crisis. By the time spring break rolled around that year, there were no less than 18 pregnant girls. Now, of course, it's the mid-aughts. You know that school pregnancy wasn't unknown in the 2000s. We all know. We all knew somebody in high school that got pregnant. Or maybe
mom was a teen mom.
Yeah, so teen moms are not a new thing. However, but like 18 in a single year, considering the population of this rural town was about 30,000 people, and it kind of seemed out of character that there were so many within this time period.
That's
about
a lot.
Yeah, it's about 4 to 5 times above the national average of the time, and also 5 times higher than the 1,200 person school had ever had. So this was a big deal seen at the time. And this, so 5 times higher than the previous year. And the school would soon learn why. Because, as you can soon tell by the fact that this is called the pregnancy pack, these 18 pregnant girls, these teenage girls, had formed a pact for themselves. They would all get pregnant at the same time and raise their children together. So they had this whole big thing going where they were making sure that they could all get pregnant in the same time frame and do this stuff. Now, by the time May rolled around, the school had administered something like 150 pregnancy tests, and some of the girls would come in through the school nurse office and talk about how disappointed they were that they were pregnant, and they weren't pregnant at the time. And another one of the girls who was pregnant slept with a 24-year-old homeless man to fulfill her part of the pact.
Wow.
Yeah, so you might think that like this is something the kind of crazy. This was an article in Time magazine in 2008. So this is where people started hearing about it, because locally there was kind of buzz about how many girls got pregnant. But 2008 hit, like when this happened, you saw articles all over. There was all this buzz about these girls and their pregnancy pact, and they just wanted to have babies. They all wanted to make babies. And of course, this is all pop culture's fault, right? Because after all, do you know what huge movie came out in 2008 about teen pregnancy?
I can't think specifically. No, tell me, what was it?
Juno, starring Elliot Page.
Okay,
Yeah.
I just recently rewatched that movie. It does hold up pretty well.
I hate that movie, but that's another story.
Okay.
I do understand, like, it achieved like critical acclaim. Everyone was talking about it. So that movie came out in 2008. Jamie Lynn Spears was also pregnant around that time, and she was a teen mom. And so you had this amazing effect on teens that all these teenagers just really wanted to get pregnant, right? That's totally a thing that could happen.
Well, this was also probably, was this around the same time where like MTV had like Teen Mom as a show, or was
That was
that
actually
later?
a year later, one
Okay.
year after this.
Okay.
So this is a thing though, but it was in the cultural zeitgeist that teens were getting pregnant, and this was just a huge rash of things happening at the time.
Okay, but also I think we have to acknowledge that in rural areas, like you don't have a lot to do as a teenager. Like you're either tipping cows or you're having sex. It's one of those
That
two. Maybe both.
is a great point that you are making, and one that is shockingly relevant to this story. Yes, it's a small fishing village too. Like, this is a small fishing town, right? There's not a whole lot going on there, and there's not a whole lot to do. But still, why were they in this like pack together to get pregnant at 16? In 2010, Lifetime produces a film called The Pregnancy Plan, which, if you haven't seen it, don't watch it, but there's some fun
Oh,
YouTube
no.
videos that
Yeah,
make
I don't
fun of
plan
it.
on it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was called The Pregnancy Plan or The Pregnancy Pact. It might have been The Pregnancy Pact. Yeah, it was The Pregnancy Pact, the 2010 film. And it has Thora Birch in it, of all people, which is
Oh.
wild. Yeah. So and Thora Birch is the mom in that movie.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, so that happens, right? So of course, this must be true. And for years, people talk about this pact of all these girls that are getting pregnant, right? In 2018, the magazine Marie Claire caught up with one of the girls, Brianna Mackey, to talk about this 10 years later. And what do you bet this girl said?
I can only imagine. I can't even. I don't know the mind of a teenage or an adult woman, girl.
Well, she had gotten pregnant when she was 16, and in 2008, she had a child. And her response when being asked about this in this time in her life was said, "So what happened with the pregnancy pact? Like, what were you girls like kind of doing and thinking?" And her response was, and I will quote her verbatim from the article, was, "It was no, hey, let's do this together," she said. As far as I know, none of the girls who got pregnant were even friends.
Okay, why? Why?
Right? Why? For Mackie, for this girl, who is a grown woman now, obviously, she said the pregnancy came as a complete surprise to her. She isn't feeling well. The clinic had tests they just administered. She took one of the tests and clearly was like, you need to give me this again because this is wrong. This test is broken. I need another one. And she was pregnant, did give birth, has a very healthy baby to this day, I'm assuming. But yeah, the pact never happened. No, there was no sweeping across the nation of teen girls idolizing pregnancy this way to the point of like getting a pact together.
Yeah, I mean, in high school, it is hard for like a group of, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Again, I do not know the inner workings of the teenage female mind, except for the fact that I was a teenage gay and, you know, there's a lot of overlap there. That Venn diagram is almost a circle. Four teenage girls as friends is troublesome enough and hard to maintain. I can't imagine 18 girls wanting to have the same goal.
Yeah. 18 girls getting like deciding to get pregnant all together. That's yeah. Like two cheerleading squads for a small like school like this, you know? Yeah. So, you know, where did this come from?
Hold on, let's go back
yeah.
to that.
No, okay.
That's a funny image to think of, two cheerleading squads where everyone is pregnant trying mm-hmm. to do like pyramids and kicks and flips and everything. It's just funny to think about. Go on.
None of the cheerleaders on my squad got pregnant until right after high school, so I can't tell you that. But yeah, so where did this come from, right? Where is this whole bug thing? I mean, this was reported everywhere.
It was in Time.
It was in The Guardian. It was on ABC News, Inside Edition, like all these places, right? But where did this come from?
I have no idea. Like,
okay.
This story continues to surprise me.
Are you ready for this? Because this yes. is wild. The story actually originated with the Time article, right? The Time article is when it kind of broke into the main news. There was one school official there were a couple of school officials that were quoted in the article. There was one very serious one main one focused in the article. And that was Joseph Sullivan, one of the vice principals of the school. He, on his own, spoke to Time magazine about this pact. And then the girls were suddenly in the middle of this media uproar. In the Time article, none of the girls are interviewed at all. There is another official that's interviewed about it, another male official interviewed about it. And then two of the concerned health officials at the school who were actually vying to have contraceptives on hand in the school the year that this was happening. Two female like workers who were like, hey, this is happening, we should have contraceptives on hand. The very Catholic area of the school, like the hospital, said, oh no, we don't want to give these girls like contraceptives. We're not going to do that because everyone's going to be in uproar about it. You know, all the parents and things like that.
Right.
So those two officials that were quoted in the article resigned in protest about not being able to hand out contraceptives. But those two in the Time article are not mentioned as mentioning a pact. This came from one person.
One male administrator.
One male administrator.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, yeah. And the weird thing was, is while all this was happening, the same year in 2008, an ABC News like article repeated all the stuff that was stated in the Time article, and then spoke to a few of the teen moms in the area. And all three of the girls that they spoke to who were quoted in the ABC article, none of them mentioned a so-called pack. But you know what they did mention? There's nothing else to do. And motherhood sometimes seems like it might be a fun time. One of the girls said that it's nothing else to do, and they're not giving these girls any other options than to get pregnant, get married, and settle down.
It's still wild. So they did actually administer like 150 pregnancy tests.
Yeah, they did that year. Suppose, according to the Time article, I can't find anything that says
we've already established the fallibility of that article. So.
Yes. And we will link the Time article in the show notes, as well as the interview in Marie Claire with one of the girls, so that you can read these for yourself. I found it was really fascinating because do you remember when this happened? I mean, you were never a teen girl, so this was never really
No, and like, we know that I hate children, especially small children, so nothing like this appeals to me. I found the whole, like, teen mom, like, kind of huge popularity thing to be distasteful in my eyes, so But like it's interesting to me that even regardless of there being a pact, that in 1 year there were 18 girls.
Yeah, that's wild. And that did happen. But because it happened, it threw them into some crazy media uproar. This was reported all over the US.
Well, it goes, and I know I said this last time, but it goes back to something we talk about a lot. Like, we want to find reasoning. We want to find a why behind it. So it's pretty unbelievable, but I can see somebody latching on to that to be like, oh, this is the only reason there could be this many pregnant teenage girls all at one time.
Yeah. And we still don't know the source that this administrator had because Marie Claire, the magazine, reached out to him and he did not offer up a comment.
Probably for the best.
Probably for the best, yeah.
Yeah.
So he never divulged where he got the information from. Did he make it up? What do you think? I don't know.
To me, I don't think he made it up, but this is a thing. All teenagers want to fuck with adults. I guarantee you, probably one of those girls came in and probably mentioned that this is what was happening, and he just ran with it.
Or he overheard it with a bunch of guys talking, like, or saying, like, oh, yeah, it was like some pact or something, you know,
Yeah.
them making a joke or somebody making a joke about it. That could very well be it. I don't know. But I find it really fascinating.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
So yes, teen pregnancy happens. That's not the urban legend, but there has never been a reported case of a pregnancy pact the same way that these quote unquote based on true stories, film and books, what have you believe.
Yeah, it just like I think just like anything else on Lifetime, take it with a grain of salt.
Very true. Very true. All right. So that's the first one up. What do you got for me next? I hear you're going to be bringing it back to some old school stuff.
You could say old school, also pretty gruesome. I
Mine was,
mean,
I started this off light, so let's go.
you say I was getting ready to say is like pregnancy in and of itself pretty gruesome.
Oh.
I'm gonna go in a different, in a different, in a different direction, gruesome
Okay.
wise and gore wise. So, have you heard of Skinned Tom before?
So the name is familiar with me. And I believe it's from Old Gods of Appalachia, which is a podcast that I adore. I think that he's mentioned in that. I know I've seen mentions of it, but actually it's a story that I'm not that familiar with. So I'm very excited to hear this.
Yeah, in Old Gods of Appalachia, it's yeah, Skint Tom
Skint. Yeah.
is the character. So Skint Tom, what I will do is I will regale you with the tale of Skint Tom, and then we will go from there. Because you know I
Okay.
love telling a story.
No, tell me a story.
So let's huddle by the digital campfire here, and let me tell you a scary story. You can turn off your lights if you want to. I have to leave mine
Oh.
on it's spooky. I live alone. In life, Tom was a good-looking guy who liked the ladies. Once he'd date all the available girls in the area, he started seeing a girl in the next town, not knowing she was married. Eventually, her husband got wind of what was going on and vowed revenge on the two of them. He told his wife he was going out of town for the weekend, then hid in the woods behind their house. As he'd guessed, that evening, Tom showed up to take the lady out. The husband followed them to the nearby Lover's Lane. Things were getting pretty hot and heavy, if you know what I mean. When all of a sudden the car door was jerked open and Tom came face to face with one very huge, very angry looking dude wielding a hunting knife. Oh no, screamed the girl who had started all the trouble in the first place. It's my husband. That's right, you cheating bitch, yelled her husband, and I'm about to teach you a lesson you'll never forget. He pulled her off Tom, rammed the knife into her stomach once, and tossed her aside. Then he turned back to Tom, grinning maniacally. Don't hurt me, Tom begged. I swear to God, I didn't know she was married. But the wronged husband didn't listen. He dragged Tom out of the car and skinned him alive with the hunting knife. Then he went to town and turned himself into the police. When the police arrived at the crime scene, they found the woman, who was miraculously still alive, but Tom was nowhere to be found. They say he's still hanging around Lover's Lane, waiting to catch a couple and teach them the same lesson his girlfriend's husband taught him. He's described as a bloody skeleton in 20s clothes, carrying the knife he himself was skinned with. All the teenagers around here grow up hearing, "Don't go to Lover's Lane if you don't want to be Skinned Tom's next victim."
Yeah, I have never heard that full story before.
I had never heard it either. And what's wild, I was just kind of searching for Lover's Lane legends and kind of trying to find some that aren't the more well-known ones. And I stumbled across this one. And the thing that's really interesting is this one is regional to us here in East Tennessee. It is out of Walland, Tennessee, is where it is originally
All
cited
right.
from. Yeah. So just a
Walland's
little
got
bit
to be known
east.
for something. There's nothing else there. Someone from Walland is listening to this right now.
I'm glad to have them as a listener. They should tell us all about what they know of Skin Tom. And the one out of Walland, the time period is in the 20s, as it mentions in the story that he's, dressed in 20s clothing. The other thing that was interesting to me about this is, are you familiar with the it's a classic ghost story, like campfire children's song. Have you seen The Ghost of John?
I don't know. So, do you want to sing it for me and I
I will
can?
not sing that for you, but
Oh, okay.
there is, to the tune of that one, there actually is one about Skin Tom, and I
Okay.
will read the lyrics to you. I will not sing
Okay,
them.
fine, I guess.
That is a horror I do not want to subject anyone to. And it's, have you seen the ghost of Skin Tom? Bloody red bones with the skin all gone. Ooh, wouldn't it be chilly with no skin on?
I have heard a version of this
Right?
song. Yes. I
Yes.
was like, have I heard this or not? Yes, I have heard that one. Not this Skin Tom version, but yes.
Yeah, so it's the ghost of John. There also sometimes it's the ghost of Tom, not Skin Tom. And the lyrics are pretty similar to that. There are some versions of this one, like whenever she's left alive, it's specifically so she can hear Tom screams as he's
Oh.
being killed. Or she tries to stop the husband and she flees, leaving the scene to leave Tom to his fate. As we both like to do anytime we're talking about an urban legend, I wanted to try to get to the origin of it, to try to find out where it
Yes.
came from, especially since it was regional. I wanted to find if it was based off of any true crime in the area or if there was something that happened that kind of sparked the tale. I couldn't find anything. Every time I dug deeper and went to a source where one person was telling it, that source was just another person telling the story. So, unlike most of the urban legends where we're able to kind of find a kernel of where it came from, everything just led to, oh, well, here's another version of the story. This is the one I heard from a friend. Like it was a total like FOAF circle is all it was.
Interesting. Like, that's really fun because it's like, I wonder, are there any like well-known storytellers who have told this story or
Not
that
that I
you know
could
of?
find,
Okay.
yeah. I'd be interested if we ever had the chance. I mean, this is kind of dream calls. If we ever had a chance to talk to the folks from Old Gods of Appalachia, like where specifically they heard it from, to see if that person has any idea where it may have started from. Because like when I was looking for other variations on it that possibly were out of other areas, I did find one other one, and it takes place in Illinois. So not even like another southern state or anything that's like a neighboring state, and it takes place in the 30s. And in that one, he actually has a full name. It's Thomas Beltran. I tried to search Thomas Beltran connected to this, couldn't find anything there either. In that telling of the story, he is depicted as much more of like a charlatan with a silver tongue who supplemented his income by wooing lonely women. He would steal things from the women and then take them to other women to get on their good sides. So he's on a train going to visit one of his many female suitors, and he is bragging essentially to another guy on the train about his scheme as he's going to this woman's house. He notices, because he is very into like stealing jewelry from these people, he notices that man has a very nice watch on. So he gets to where he's going, and the woman's husband arrives, and it just happens to be the man on the train that he
Of
had told the
course.
story to earlier. Yeah, what are the coincidences that that
That's
happened? Yeah,
that feels like a car more of a karma story too of that, yeah.
So he ends up it, that ends up being the woman's husband, and he chases Tom out of the house with a kitchen knife instead of a
Okay.
hunting knife. And in that version, neither the husband nor Tom are seen for a period of time. Like the woman eventually is like, okay, they're not coming back. Hours later, he appears back at the house with no skin and his tongue cut out.
Oh, well. The losing the tongue is only in this version?
Only in that version, yes.
Which makes sense since he's a smooth talker, specifically.
He has in a silver that tongue. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes sense.
But yeah, like you said, you actually bring up a really good point because obviously I think the original telling of it is like a lot of these is a cautionary tale to scare mm-hmm. teenagers to not go out necking, but also like a morality tale about the dangers of infidelity. Whereas the one that's based out of Illinois is, I mean, it still has that element to it, but it's also just kind of more of a karmic thing. Like you reap what you sow if you're out bragging about this type of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Like I had never heard that one. I really, now I want to go see if this, we can find any more research on it. I love these weird sort of tales. And you're like, no, there's none.
No, I want somebody to find it. Like that's my want, is to know where it came from. But like, I was like, I got so excited every time I found a new source where it's like, oh, I would be reading the story. And then at the bottom of the article or the site that I was on, it would, you know, have the link for source. And I was like, ooh, ooh, here it comes. Here it is. Here, I'm going to get it. And it was just somebody else telling the story.
Don't you love that?
And the, whereas like a lot of these urban legends have pretty significant variations in them, especially whenever it comes to like regionality, also the time period in which it's being told, because time does weigh very heavy on some of these as far as like things being updated in them, except for the small variations that I mentioned. And that one version from Illinois, everything is exactly the same. And I had never heard of this before, but a lot of like what I found online looking into it, people consider this to be like the scariest haunted thing in Tennessee. And I'm like, I have no idea about this.
There's so much fun haunted things in Tennessee too. This is the,
for this to be the one, and like it was on many a list. I mean, obviously I was looking at listicles because we all know I love list. And then also in looking at it, there's a pretty, I don't want to say devoted, but there's a pretty healthy community online that are obsessed with this story. And I found all kinds of art, like fan art of Skin Tom. And I will show you a couple here. Like, so there's this one.
Oh, all right. So that is what I'm seeing is an almost like anatomical drawing of a man who is holding his own skin. That is what I am looking at right now. Correct. And he's actually holding the knife himself.
Yes. Because he does.
Because of that. Yes.
Yeah. He does end up using the knife. And there are like a couple of the variants and versions of it where once the husband skins Tom, he hangs the skin from a tree like nearby as kind of a warning.
Okay.
And then like there's this one that is like super, super, like super scary. If you want to describe what you're seeing there.
So this one is I'll be honest with you. This guy looks a little bit like Darkman without his bandages on for a very deep cut from a movie. But it's not a bad thing. I want to point out this is not a bad thing. But he has kind of got someone's skin that he is holding the face of it directly towards the viewer and pulling the rest of it back. So he's kind of got it like it's a pelt, basically.
There is this variation on it that has him as for some reason, a very muscled man.
That, I think it's also the fact that like he's in pants, which is probably a good thing. You should wear pants.
If you don't have skin, probably good to wear
pants. If you don't have skin, you should probably wear pants. But he's like, it's a very kind of like watercolor-esque, I think it's a computer drawing, but it's a watercolor-esque, a big muscle daddy holding the knife with not, I kind of like that one because it's very like non-features. You don't see a whole lot of the gore in it, but.
I look at this guy and I'm fairly certain I've seen him at a gay club before with the way that he's dressed.
That's what I said. He's like a muscle daddy, that version of Tom.
Yeah. So. And I have one more to show you. And this one I kind of really like because it is much more kind of folk artsy. And it looks like this was done just recently in October of 2023.
Oh, that one feels like it's drawing inspiration of some of the old like manuscripts from the quote unquote Dark Ages where you have these like illuminated scripts because with the pose. So it looks a little like that or like a tarot. And he's half peeled in that one. It's
And it's almost like a dress. Yeah, I
Yeah,
kind of really like that one.
the way that the skin is peeled off over his like lower half, it looks like he's wearing like a dress or something. It could be a tarot card. That looks vaguely like some manuscript inspired tarot art.
Yes. So it's just interesting to me that there is obviously a community out there who loves this urban legend
Oh
enough
yeah.
to like do art on it.
And
And yet again, like neither of us had heard of it before.
we'll post as many as we can with the credit on Instagram for this episode. So check out our Instagram if you would like to see some of this, especially Muscle Daddy.
Muscle Daddy Skin Tom, yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of want. We both know I hate Grindr. I don't have Grindr. I kind of want to download Grindr and make a profile and put that as the profile picture.
All right, I would love to see what sort of response you get to
I think it would be scary. It's either going to be
that.
really scary or really funny, one of the two. There could be overlap there. That does happen sometimes.
Possibly, possibly.
Sadly, it'll probably get more attention than my normal one would.
Oh my gosh.
It
So
Go ahead.
no, I'm good.
Are you good? So that's the legend of Skin Tom.
Wonderful, wonderful. So now that you have brought up Grindr, which is not an app that I'm on, nor is
I would
Tinder
hope
for that
not.
matter. Yes, nor is Tinder for that matter. So have you ever done a Tinder date or a Grindr date?
Well, you don't really do Grindr
Okay,
dates.
yeah, I know. You know what I'm saying. Like
Yes, I have actually had a date off of someone, and I know I have had a date off of Grindr and also off of Tinder. Yes.
okay. I just said, because like I barely dipped my toes into online dating, I'll be honest with you. And it's kind of a
You're
horror
very
horror show.
lucky.
Yeah, it's a
Very, very
horror show in
lucky.
itself. I don't understand a lot of modern dating, I'll be absolutely honest with you. It's kind of the advantage that I have now is I don't have to. But yeah, there's like so many horror stories involving Grindr and Tinder. So I thought it would actually be fun to talk about one of the very many Tinder nightmare stories that
Yes,
have been
I'm into
circulating.
this.
Yeah,
Yes.
I know you are. I know you are. So the one that I want to talk about is actually kind of interesting because there's a bunch of like smaller ones with smaller stakes. Like the I read a couple of them and I was like, oh no, these all involve some sort of like fecal matter or things that I just really don't want to talk about in here. So this one I thought was really interesting, and I think this started circulating around 2016, and I found it.
Oh, so very new.
This is a very new one. Like I found what well, it's new and yet not, which is why it's really fun to talk about. And I found it through an article on Jezebel.com from Madeline Davies, and we'll link this article in the show notes so you can read it too. Because she, the title of this article is My Endless Quest to Find the Woman in This Terrifying Tinder Urban Legend. So I was sort of like researching some like modern like dating horror stories when I found this. Yeah, let's talk about this story as she relates it. And like she kind of dates it back to 2016, which is probably about right, I would hear. And this was a story that was actually not really found online that much. It was kind of told orally. It was a friend of a friend who told these sorts of stories.
That's
So
interesting to get a more oral tradition one in this day and age and then not
yeah.
be online. Yeah.
Which is why this one pinged me a whole lot. So I was very curious about it. So let me know if this starts to sound a little bit familiar to you. A 20-something-year-old woman who has just moved to Boston to start her graduate program has an aunt who is going to be away in Europe for a month. Now, the aunt offers up her home in the suburbs as a crash pad until the woman finds something more permanent and centrally located. So soon after moving in, the woman begins to hear odd noises, but chalks it up to a standard settling of old buildings. Still, her unease persists until she decides to call her father for peace of mind. He agrees it's probably nothing, but encourages her to call the police and have them check it out, just in case. The woman calls 911 and explains her worries to the dispatcher, all while recognizing it's probably nothing, which, as you know, is something women often do when they feel uncomfortable. I'm probably overreacting,
Explain it
but
away.
explain it away. Okay. So The dispatcher asks if she's alone in the house, and she says yes, and agrees that it's probably paranoia, but she promises to send an officer when one is available. That said, you know, it's a very busy night, and it'll probably be about 40 minutes before she can get anyone out there. In the meantime, the dispatcher agrees to stay on the line with the woman just in case anything happens, in case of an emergency. Not 3 minutes later, a squadron of police cars screech onto her aunt's lawn. The police search her house and find a man in the basement, along with an intricate layout of sinister tools that could be used to torture or dismember a human body.
Oh no.
Upon seeing the squatter, the woman immediately recognizes him as a recent Tinder date who learned she was staying alone in the house after dropping her off following an odd, but not really alarming date. The dispatcher, so the story goes, had been bluffing during the woman's 911 call, having heard strange activity, the sound of someone listening in, on the woman's landline. By saying the police would arrive in 40 minutes, the dispatcher hoped to take the intruder by surprise, and before he could do anything violent. Have you ever heard the story before?
I mean, the call is coming from inside the house.
It absolutely is. But it is a repackaged version for the modern era, which I find as fascinating. And doing a little research, Madeline, who wrote this original article, and there's several articles I found about this urban legend. I found out this one was really great. She discovered where this version of the story came from. And because here's the thing, many women were passing it around orally and not through the internet. I never saw this on the Dreaded Beast Facebook or even on the app formerly known as Twitter. Like none of that.
It's still Twitter. It will always and forever be Twitter.
It's the bird app. I understand. Never saw it on there. It was apparently very much spread around orally. But do you want to know where this one probably came from?
Where?
A little podcast called My Favorite Murder.
I am familiar with it.
Yes, I think we all are familiar with it. Apparently, this came through they have a couple where they tell listener submitted stories, where the two hosts will tell stories that the listeners kind of write in with them to do. And they kind of, I don't know if they react blind to them or what, but here's the thing with those stories. They're not verified. Like there's no verification process that goes in those. And they're not vetted. They don't ask for people's names or where this happened. And in this story that they told on the podcast, it was in the Adirondacks, was where the cabin was that she was staying in. And that the man knew she was staying there and was building like some sort of weird cage in her basement for her.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that like, I would hope that most people who are listening to these understand that like a lot of the like listener submitted ones are strictly just for like entertainment purposes.
Right.
But here's the thing. The minute you add specificity to a story, like whenever you're saying like, you know, they mentioned the Adirondacks, that for some reason gives weight to it. It gives credibility to it in some way.
if you give a location to it, it does. But it is interesting that a story told in like 2016 has a landline, let's be honest. Although, to be fair,
in a mountainous area like that, you might
in a mountainous
have
area
one.
Like yeah. that, or again, we have mentioned East Tennessee, and I work with a lot of rural communities, and I will tell you, landlines are far more like they're more prevalent than you would think they are still to this day in these mountainous areas where it's very specifically mountainous areas where it's very hard to get calls in or out. So there are some places still without cell service, like I have to go to one occasionally for work, and it's kind of scary when you're just like, oh no, everything is dropped. I have nothing. So yeah, a lot of people still have landlines, especially like an elderly aunt or something like that. But this is the call is coming from inside the house.
Listening to this, like whenever you got to the end of it, one of the other things that kind of stuck out to me is, and I think it's pretty common in a lot of these urban legends and cautionary tales is that like it puts all of the, like the burden of responsibility on the woman. Like, you know, like you should have never have let him drop you off.
Right.
You know, at your home after this weird date. Mm-hmm. I love that so many of these are like meant to scare you, but I don't know. it's the patriarchy, man.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it does really feel like that, especially when it's one of those like the woman didn't keep herself safe, so someone knew where she lived. And this has been a thing that's been like going on for ages. Like, have you ever had a version of this story told to you at all?
I think whenever I was younger, like when I was
Okay.
considerably younger, when I was younger, when landlines were much more prevalent.
Yes. So I have actually been told a version of the story probably back in the early 2000s, like sometime in the 2000s. I can't remember, was I in college or high school? Like, so I can't give you an era for it. But the version that I was told was very similar to this, except that the people kept hearing strange noises in the house. And when they called, the dispatcher told them to leave the house. And when they left, someone busted through the window to get out of the house. And they found by the time the cops arrived, nobody was there, but there was an indentation in the closet where somebody was.
Oh, somebody had been living in the walls.
And it was still warm. Weirdly enough, there are cases where people still like have been living in the walls of houses. That's a real thing, which is wild. But in this case, no, I think they were just waiting for this person to be home alone. That was as the story was presented to me. But again, it was told in the classic sense of this happened to a friend of a friend. But it really
FOAF.
happens, and there's evidence to prove it, but we never see this evidence. So, like this one, we've never like.
What's your source? Trust me, bro.
Trust me, bro. Yeah. There's never been a police report. Supposedly, the person who this happened to was going to be writing a first person account of this in 17 magazine, which never like appeared. And there's been nothing in police record at all to be able to suggest that this is the thing that actually like happened as presented. But as you said, this is an example of a much earlier story, which is the calls coming from inside the house. And that story is far older than this one. And usually, instead of involving a Tinder date, we're going to pull it back to some more old school urban legends with us, because I went on some deep dives here. It's really just kind of like to pull it back to kind of the babysitter, where the babysitter gets an unusual call and asking her if she's checked the children. Have you checked the children? Have you checked the children? And she gets a couple of these crank calls, and like she'll be like, the kids are fine, they're all asleep, this babysitter. And she'll call the police finally and be like, I'm getting all these like creepy calls, what's happening? And eventually the dispatch will tell her, get out of the house, there's someone in the house with you, like we've tracked it back to your house is where the call's coming from. One version of it is, and the other version is like, hey, we can hear somebody on the other line, like, you know, the voice is a click that there's someone else in the house with you. And in some cases, the children have been killed. Some cases, the children are fine. She gets all of them out. It depends on the different version of the story that you've been told. And if this sounds familiar, it really should, because it's been in how many movies now? Including the precursor to most slasher films as we know them, 1974's Black Christmas, which is, if you have not seen it, is probably the slasher movie to watch. It predates Halloween, which is also another one that it deals with a babysitter dealing with a pseudo supernatural threat, unclear in the first Halloween. I know there's sequels, we'll talk about those at some point in time, but in the first one, you know, Michael Myers is not supernatural yet. And then, of course, like the one that the first part of this movie comes from, which is 1979's When a Stranger Calls, where the first 30 minutes deal with exactly this. So everyone's heard this story, right?
Everyone's heard it, and I think that it's interesting kind of how it morphs over time, especially whenever we like just thinking of like the telecommunication standpoint of it all. Like, I think it's funny that it's like, oh, we've traced the call back to the house, as if that's something that is just commonly able to be done by any like 911 dispatch. I mean, I don't know how any of that works, but I venture that even like back then, that wasn't something that you could just push a button and start tracing a call like that easily. But I do think that probably in the age when whenever party lines and stuff like that were much more common, mm-hmm. that you would be more apt to know, like, okay, there is somebody else on the phone. Or like you said, if there are multiple phones in a house, you know, there's only one line, you can hear somebody breathing or picking up, or like, we all know, we've all tried to be on calls late at night without our parents knowing when we were younger. So,
oh, especially if we had a landline, you could hear someone clicking and picking it up.
So it definitely plausible, but it's, and I kind of was, I'd always wondered like how it would morph and if it would have lasting power into kind of the internet and digital age that we are now. And apparently it does. It still has legs.
As
and a Tinder profile.
A Tinder profile now, that's what we're going with. Well, do you know the origin of the calls coming from inside the house? Do you know kind of the, so this is an urban legend that actually has a kind of horrific origin story. And we're not a true crime podcast, and I want to point this out now, but this is based on true events in a way that I think is kind of like important relevant. To talk about. Yeah. It's relevant in this situation to talk about. All of these things, like how the baby Halloween with the babysitter, you know, murders, all these things can be traced back to one true story and a very horrifying true story of the murder of a 13-year-old girl in 1950. This is the story of Janet Kreisman, who was a babysitter that was killed while babysitting a young boy. And I think it's important to say her name. I think it's important to know a little bit about her and like who she was, because she was a very bright, clever girl in the eighth grade when this happened. And this was in an era where this didn't happen. This was March 18th, 1950. And I think that's why this has stayed with us for so long. On the night of March 18th in 1950, eighth grader Janet Kreisman went to babysit for the three-year-old son of a family that she knew. And his parents were going to go out to play cards with friends for the evening. The young boy was already in bed when she arrived at 7:30, so it was going to be a relatively easy night for her, right? Now, the family had recently moved to a more rural area of Columbia, Missouri. And as such, the father, who was really concerned, wanted to make sure everything was safe. He told Janet to, if anyone knocked at the door, turn the porch light on, not to answer the door unless she absolutely knew the person. Don't talk to them. Don't do anything like that. They also showed her, before he left, he showed her how to load, hold, and fire the shotgun they kept next to the door for security. So this family was very serious about like, hey, we just kind of moved to this place. We're not really sure about it. We want you to be really safe.
Right.
So they left with the baby in bed and young Janet watching him. At around 10 p.m., the mother called the house. And when no one answered, she wasn't super worried because it was 10 p.m. And she kind of assumed that Janet had fallen asleep, which is a thing that happens. You know, you're babysitting, you're kind of staying on the couch. She might have fallen asleep or gone somewhere to sleep. So she wasn't like super, super worried about it because, you know, Janet babysat for them before. This is a thing. But unfortunately, at 10:35 p.m., the Columbia Police Department received a phone call. And it was a frantic phone call from a young woman begging for help. And she was like, help, come quick. They heard a lot of noise in the background, and then the line went dead. And this was, of course, 1950, so they couldn't trace calls.
Right.
And now there's no way of figuring out what's going on. We don't have all the laws and regulations surrounding, you know, any sort of 911. She directly called the police station. They were unable to do anything because they didn't know where it was. At around 1:30 a.m., the couple came home from playing cards at a friend's house, and they discovered that their door was unlocked, the porch light was on, and nobody seemed to be moving in the house. But when they went in, they discovered that Janet was in the living room and she was dead. Now, the thing about Janet that I really want to point out here when telling the story is this girl fought like hell. She had defensive wounds. She had clearly gone after her attacker, but she was unfortunately overwhelmed and her attacker killed her. So this is a real thing that happened in 1950. And the shittiest part of all of this case is still unsolved. They don't know for sure who killed her. So of course, like there was some weird evidence in the house. There was a wooden sawhorse that had been set next to one of the windows, that, and then there was a piece of equipment that was inside the house that someone thought had been used to bust out a window. But it, when they told them that, I can't remember, it was like a garden hoe or something, they said, actually, we kept that inside the house, so it's weird that it was outside the house when it was supposed to be kept inside. Mm-hmm. So was that meant to lead people off of the trail, that it was a break-in? At the time, I mean, 1950s police sort of bungled this case. Let's be honest. There was a, the investigation was fraught with a lot of like racial bias, where they interviewed a whole lot of Black men, but not a whole lot of white men about this. And there also was some coercive interrogations involved. And eventually no one was found to be the murderer. The weird thing about the story is in the same area, there were several other like attacks in the area and another murder that happened 3 years prior. They probably wrongfully convicted a man for that. And they do to this day think they know who the culprit might have been. There's a lot of investigation about it. I'm going to link in the notes an article that I read reading about this from, I think it's a Midwestern like kind of crime in the area, doing a full case report on this to talk about it. But to this day, that no one has ever been convicted for her murder, but there's a pretty good chance it was somebody she knew and let into the house. And there was a man who was investigated around the same time who was actually playing cards with the couple when they were there, like at the house playing with him, and had left the party from around 10 p.m. to 11 p.m.
And the call was at 10:35.
And the call was at 10:35. So I think that like in talking about these urban legends and making films about them and things like that, it's really easy to forget the kind of victims who are behind these real crimes, which honestly is even scarier, you know, for these reasons. And I think it's important to remember Janet. And I really think it's important to like keep her in mind when you hear some of these more outlandish urban legends, that like there are really terrible people out there and they will do terrible things, but not the ones you hear about your Tinder date making a torture basement is probably not the thing you have to watch out for.
Well, like real life is horrifying yes. enough.
Yes, absolutely.
Having to embellish it. Yeah.
No, that is really the core of that. Mm-hmm. And I think you put it exactly right. Real life is bad enough. They don't have to add things to the stories.
Question. So whenever, like, was the child just, like, left unharmed?
Oh, the baby was sleeping upstairs. He was absolutely fine.
Still sleeping. So it had to be somebody that she knew. It had to be somebody that she knew.
Yeah. Which is why I find these stories about stranger danger, and a lot of times another form of moral panic, when it's most likely somebody this girl knew.
Well, because I think it's like, I can't remember what the statistic is, but I know that it's pretty high, that if you are going to be a victim of murder, you probably already know the person who will perpetrate the crime. Like,
statistically speaking, yes, that is kind of the scariest thing about any of this.
Like, not to laugh at it, to make fun of it, but just no. it's like unreal. Yeah.
Sometimes you laugh about things because you're just like, if I don't laugh, I might cry right now. So,
I mean, it's the same reason we embellish this stuff. Like, if we can make it seem outlandish and unrealistic, and then that helps us to be like, this could never happen, whenever it can happen. And it does. Yeah.
Yeah. So next time you hear the story of there's someone inside the house that in this case, it's unlikely that there was anyone inside the house at first, but this is most likely the murder that sparked this interest in babysitter murders, and the calls coming from inside the house and someone lying in wait for you in your own home.
Oh my God. It's like three different tropes all rolled into one.
It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to try to follow that.
Sorry.
No. I'm going to take it to a place of something that, for what we know, it does not have any realistic, like, it doesn't have an anchor in reality at all. And that is going to be what is probably the most well-known Lover's Lane urban legend. Do you, Care to guess what it is?
I mean, there's only one it can be. I'm gonna give it a drum roll and then, so, 'cause we all know. Here we go.
Oh, I thought you were doing a drum. Did you do a drum roll?
Oh, did it not come up? Hang on. Never mind. We'll just pretend that happened. You can just cut that out there. My
No,
drum
I'm
roll.
leaving it. I'm
No,
leaving
you
it.
can't
I'm
hear my
leaving
drum
it.
roll. My little like mic shield is too good.
It's the hook.
Of course, you can't talk about dating urban legends without talking about the hook.
The hook. It's one that we've all known since we were children. And even though our listeners probably know it, I'm still going to read it to everyone because it comes from the holy text itself, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
The first one.
The very first one. And I have this old copy that is still in great condition, collected from folklore and retold by the wonderful Alvin Schwartz, with terrifying, nightmare-inducing drawings by Stephen Gamble. I want a tattoo of one of these drawings, but it needs to be in a place that I can't see it because I feel like if I see it all the time.
He just
Tangent. You know that I bought those pajamas, those Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark
Yeah.
pajamas, like that entire set that has a like an all-over print of all of the drawings from it. I do not wear those that often because I will look down at my arms or my legs and spook myself. I'll get scared.
So here's my question for that. If you get this tattoo, what are you gonna do when you have somebody over and you're getting kind of intimate and then they're suddenly like, gah, bagul, like right on your arm? What do you or wherever you've got it, what are you gonna do then? Maybe some people that would put them in the mood, but
I think that, let's be honest, the type of people I'm into, they would probably be very, very into that. The question
okay.
is, which one do I get?
Ooh, there's so many to choose from. I don't even know where to start with that
I wish I
one.
could remember the story, but there's like one in particular that I know I've talked about it before. Like there's one drawing in particular on one of the stories that I would have nightmares about as a kid. Like I would kind of hit that space where I was having like a night terror, or I was kind of awake but still asleep, and I would see the image of
Oh
this
God.
drawing on the wall. Yeah, fun stuff. Yeah, childhood was real fun for me. Anywho, let's hear the story of The Hook.
Let's go.
Donald and Sarah went to the movies. Then they went for a ride in Donald's car. They parked up on a hill at the edge of town. From there, they could see the lights up and down the valley. Donald turned on the radio and found some music, but an announcer broke in with a news bulletin. A murderer had escaped from the state prison. He was armed with a knife and was headed south on foot. His left hand was missing. In its place, he wore a hook. "Let's roll up the windows and lock the door," said Sarah. "That's a good idea," said Donald. "That prison isn't too far away," said Sarah. "Maybe we should really go home." "Voice of reason, Sarah." "But it's only 10 o'clock," said Donald. "Typical male response, Donald." "I don't care what time it is," she said. "I want to go home." "Look, Sarah," said Donald. "He's not going to climb all the way up here. Why would he do that? Even if he did, all the doors are locked. How could he get in?" "Donald, he could take that hook and break through a window and open a door," she said. "I'm scared. I want to go home." Donald was annoyed. "Girls are always afraid of something," he said. As he started the car, Sarah thought she heard something or someone scratching at her door. "Did you hear that?" she asked as they roared away. "It sounded like somebody was trying to get in." "Oh, sure," said Donald. Soon they got to her house. "Would you like to come in and have some cocoa?" she asked. "No," he said. "I've got to go home." He went around to the other side of the car to let her out. Hanging on the door handle was a hook.
Dun dun
Dun,
dun.
dun, dun. It
That is a classic. I,
is a
you know,
classic.
it is a classic story.
I think I would venture to say that I do not know anyone who is not familiar with that story at all, and especially like the version that's in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Worth noting that one of the things I love about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is it's a book for children, but it does have like an awesome index of like resources and kind of some additional information on the stories that Alvin Schwartz puts in there. And the version of the hook that's in Scary Stories is not based on any particular known variant. It's just kind of a generic version.
Okay.
So let's talk about some variants.
Yeah, let's tell me some variants.
Let's possibly maybe go into a list. So, in researching this, I found in Southern Folklore Quarterly, Volume 30, Daniel R. Barnes actually has a really good kind of entry about the hook and some other Lover's Lane urban legends that are somewhat tied to this.
Okay.
So, I think probably the most wildly different, but probably most other well-known variant of this story is the Hangman's Road variant. Are you familiar with that one?
I am absolutely familiar with that one. That those are the two that I think always almost think interchangeably. So,
Yes. So tell me what you know of that one.
in that one, there are it, according to what I remember, it follows the same plot of two characters that are up having a good time, doing a little necking out in the middle of nowhere. They're enjoying themselves, and then she hears something, and she gets a little afraid. So her boyfriend at the time is like, no, it's fine, baby, it's fine. And she's like, no, I'm not gonna be in the mood when I keep hearing weird stuff outside the car. That's not sexy. So he is vaguely annoyed by this, and then gets out of the
As
car to go,
teenage men
as
are.
teenage men are, gets out of the car to go check, and she's waiting, and she's waiting. And she hears something on the top of the car. Usually, I believe it's a noise on top of the car that's
Correct.
like a tap, tap, tapping. And she is terrified by that noise. And I think that there are probably two versions that I'm familiar with. One, she hears a noise that just terrifies her and gets into the driver's seat and drives away. And in the other version, she locks all the car doors and waits for him all night until the morning. In either version of the story, the outcome is typically the same, which is when dawn arises and she is able to feel safe enough to leave the vehicle, whether by driving away or not, she realizes that the killer has strung her boyfriend up above the vehicle on a tree, right? And then attached the rope through a weird pulley system, somehow magical pulley system with a tree, through to the fender, the rear fender of the car. So that in the case where she hears the tap, tap, tap on the roof, that's him. And if she'd only left the vehicle, she could have saved him, but probably died herself. And in the case where she drove away, she actively hung him. So in either way, he ends in hanging, right? Is
I
that
have not heard that second
you
one.
haven't? Like the
No,
one where she drives away?
and it hangs them. Yeah, I've
Oh,
never
yeah,
heard
and it
that one
hangs him.
before.
Yeah, I've heard that one before.
So
Well, that's
that,
a, like, sorry, go ahead.
no, it's interesting that like there are still like so many variants and versions of this that
Yeah.
like it's impossible to know them all. The one that Daniel Barnes talks about in that Southern Folklore Quarterly article is and the way that it's worded and the way it was told to him, and we'll get into it a little bit more, is like one of those situations where there's details to give it credibility. And in that one,
Yes.
they've been drinking and he needs to go take a leak. And so he
Oh,
gets out of
okay.
the car to like go
Yeah.
into like the forest to pee. And that's whenever when the event happens. And in that one, it is the situation where she just huddles in the car until dawn, and then the passerbys find her, and that's whenever they
Sees
discover
it.
him on the roof. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that version of the story, I actually, my mom told me that version when I was a little kid because I like to hear stories that scared me, and we spent a lot of time in the car together, my mom and I, driving around because through her work she had to drive to a lot of places. So I'm quite familiar with a bunch of these weird urban legends through my mother telling me these terrible stories that if you go dig boys in the woods, like one of you is going to
What if
die.
he's gonna die? How did she position it as far as like how she had heard it? Did she just say, "Let me tell you the story," or did she, was it a like a friend of a friend situation?
It was a, this is a true story. I'm gonna tell you a true story sort of thing. And I think, I really feel like I might have been in single digits when these stories were told to me. So I need you to know that when my mom said something was real, I believed her. Okay. I was still young enough to be like,
Parents know everything.
oh,
Yeah.
parents know everything at that age. I was like, oh my God, what? And that one, especially the hangman story, is like is real enough that it could have, quote unquote, like could have happened. You know what I'm saying? Is whereas the hook hand, I was like, ain't nobody leaving their hook hand in a door. But I don't know. Small me, small child me had a lot of like, you know, there was some logic that I had to follow. But the
No, I
secondary
love
story
that.
was, yeah, was definitely one that I believed fully until I was probably like 12.
Well, and the Hangman's Road variant, the way that that one kind of gets credibility is that variation on the story is more popular in places that actually do have a place that's called Hangman's Road, because then you
Okay.
have a location that you can direct it to. Some other variants in the story are the means of notification, in which the woman in the car, or the couple in the car knows about the hook hand, or what's going to happen with the hanging. It's just like a silhouette in the moonlight, shouting passerby, a direct recognition, frightened by a noise, or just a general unease that causes them to leave. Some variants substitute a glove for the hook hand.
Okay.
And I want to come back to that a little bit later, so keep that just in the back of your head about something being a little bit different. On the ones where it was a glove, what I found was those kind of involved, they kind of seemed almost like a little bit of a hybrid mix with a vanishing hitchhiker type thing, because it was around, like, they were usually around cemeteries. And as we both know from when we discussed vanishing hitchhikers and a lot of those, a lot of it is about leaving a physical object in the car or near the vehicle to. So you can't just explain away, well, maybe I was imagining things. Like, there is physical evidence to tie the encounter
So this
to.
happened, yeah.
As I've already stated a little bit, like, these are not just this urban legend, but lots of urban legends. The way that they're given credibility is by actually having specific features. Like, this happened on Mulberry Hill, in the town that you live in. It gives a location to it, or details like, yeah, the car was, quote unquote, one of those Chevys with a slope back, so it was really easy for the killer to get into. Like, the more kind of details, and the more mundane the details are, the more believable it makes the legend.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Daniel Barnes, in his article, also talks about how not just this one, but other Lover's Lane urban legends and ones that are kind of more directed toward teens are structured in a particular way in order to have them have, like, weight and a little bit more oomph, and for them to be a little bit more believable to teens. So we're like, whereas, like, if you are an adult figure, or say, for instance, you are like an RA at a dorm or something like that, if you just say, don't do this thing, kids are gonna do it, or
They're going to do the
they're not
thing.
gonna listen to you at all. What you have to have is you have to have an interdiction, you have to have a violation of that interdiction, and then some sort of consequence to make it believable. So in this case, it's like, don't park. The violation is they go parking. And then the consequence, hanging a boyfriend or hook hand. It's one of those things. So even though it's this kind of outlandish thing, it still, in a lot of cases, will deter a younger mind from doing these things. Even if they don't believe it, it gives enough of, like, a paint a picture and gives enough light to it to kind of keep you from doing certain things.
So where did these come from?
So origins of this are not entirely known, but one comes from one of our personal saints, Jan Harald Grunwald, from the Holy Text of the Vanishing Hitchhiker, American Urban Legends and Their Meanings, which we have
Which is a
referenced before.
great book,
A
yeah.
great book. So he states that it began to circulate in the 50s and became pretty widespread by American teenagers by 1959, and continued to expand into the 60s. So we can kind of tie it to when car culture was becoming a huge thing. Whenever, like, the idea of, like, a date on a Friday night would be, let's go around driving, let's possibly go to a drive-in, and then let's go park and make out.
So the timing of these, and this is just the question, like, are you familiar with the Texarkana murders?
I was getting ready to
Yeah.
bring that
All
up.
right, tell me everything about it. That's what I was wondering. I was like, did you find anything about that in there? I'm just curious because of the timing of these.
Yes. So Snopes writer David Mikkelsen speculated that it could be tied to real-life Lovers Lane murders, like the 1946 Texarkana Moonlight murders, which, as we both know, and anybody who isn't a horror aficionado knows, inspired the 1976 film.
The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Exactly.
Which is a really horrific film, honestly, in a lot of ways. And a weird cultural thing for that town, but we can get into that later.
Yeah, Texarkana is a weird place just in general.
Like, real murders, real things happen. They show the movie every year. Like, they have an event around it. And I'm like, that's a lot of people that died. Like, real, like, okay, sure, Texarkana, you have a good time.
But, like, how is that any different than, like, Woodsboro having a festival every year to, like, commemorate
the Scream murders? That is sort of the thing. Yeah. No, I'm saying, like, that's sort of the thing. Like, art imitating life or life imitating art.
Yeah.
Which is it? Sometimes it can go either way. But, yeah. Yeah, the Texarkana murders are really, really gruesome. And I think if you've seen The Town That Dreaded Sundown, they are actually based on real events. And I use that actually as a, no, these were actually real murders. And it kind of outlines it. It sensationalizes a lot of the murders, but no, they really happened.
Like, it's not like a situation like Texas Chainsaw Massacre where it's like, this is based on real events. It's like, yeah, you piece together a bunch of stuff to make this, but like,
yeah,
that is, yeah, again, sensationalized, but pretty right on point.
Yeah.
The first known publication of the mm-hmm. story was in November 8th, 1960, and it was actually in the Dear Abby column.
Okay. Yes. A lot of weird urban legends show up in Dear Abby.
Yes. So I will read. This was the entry from this one. Dear Abby, if you're interested in teenagers, you will print this story. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it doesn't matter because it served its purpose for me. A fellow and his date pulled into their favorite Lover's Lane to listen to the radio and do a little necking. The music was interrupted by an announcer who said that there was an escaped convict in the area who had served time for rape and robbery. He was described as having a hook instead of a right hand. The couple became frightened and drove away. When the boy took his girl home, he went around to the car door. Then he saw a hook on the door handle. I will never park to make out as long as I live. I hope this does the same for other kids. Jeanette.
All right. What year was that? It was like, sorry, you said it, but what was the year again?
1960.
Okay.
59 is whenever it got really, really big. And then mm-hmm. 60 is when this happened. And then it just kind of continued to expand from there. Because, as you know, again, car culture was a thing that, like,
yeah,
it was still huge up until, I mean, I would say even up until like the 90s, which is kind of like the era that we grew up in, which is when we heard this, it still kind of had a little bit of like weight and scariness to it. I think if you told this to like a teenager now, they'd be like, whatever.
That's dumb.
That's dumb.
I think that they'd be like, yeah, that's stupid. What is that? But it makes sense why it would be so prevalent in the car culture era, because that was a time, dating was really new back mm-hmm. then too. You didn't have dating until in the modern era that it is now, until after World War II. People didn't date like they do now.
Or if they did date, like, the parents were around. Like, this was kind of like, this was the first time like you could have that independence from your parents. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting interpretations.
Okay.
Of the story.
Oh, yes. I love this.
So Alan Dundas, his Freudian interpretation explains the hook as a phallic symbol and its amputation as a symbolic castration. That is the appropriate look to have on your face for that.
So this just furthers my theory that men will make everything about their penis if given half a chance. Why not?
No. As a man, I agree.
Yeah. If you have a penis, I guess that's your whole world. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I have a lot of decades of experience in like living this life. So
listen, I've seen a lot of dicks in my lifetime. Men make that their entire personality sometimes. It can only be so big and so pretty enough for you to make it your entire personality. Move on, get another trait. Moving on. Swedish folklorist Bengt af Klintberg describes the story as an example of, quote, a conflict between representatives of normal people who follow the rules of society and those who are not normal, who deviate and threaten the normal group, end quote.
Okay.
Both of these people seem like real squares.
Well, the second one really feels like that kind of like suburban fear of someone moving into your white picket fence and ruining it, you know? Like, yeah.
Hold on to that thought. Hold on to that.
Okay.
Plot.
Okay.
And then American folklorist Bill Ellis interpreted the maniac in The Hook as a moral custodian who interrupts the sexual experimentation of the young couple. He sees the hookman's disability as, quote, his own lack of sexuality and the, quote, the threat of the hookman is not the normal sex drive of teenagers, but the abnormal drive of some adults to keep them apart, end quote. Which, you have thoughts?
No, I'm just trying to like parse that out a little bit more by saying that, like, is he saying that the sexuality of teenagers is different in some form, like very specific way than the sexuality of adults?
I think,
or that the adults are afraid of teenage sexuality? Because like
that
I can
part.
get behind. Like definitely, like adults being afraid of teenage sexuality is. We can pull that back to even kind of the earlier stories that we had with like the pregnancy pack. Like adults are very terrified of the youths with a capital Y.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is where, like, you know, a lot of times we view this story through the lens of this is to discourage kids from this activity, which it is. But in like in another way, it's more for the adults in a way that like, oh, we got to keep these kids apart. This is why, this is how.
Yeah. Yeah, they have to be like, they have to uphold the standards that we upheld when we were their age, and any quote unquote deviation of the norm is bad and is not to be allowed.
Yeah. And again, at the time period, whenever this urban legend became very prevalent, you did have a very kind of set boxed in idea of what the American dream was, what your life was supposed to be. And, you know, you didn't want to be abnormal or different in any way at all. Like you wanted, everything needed to be homogenous. Everything needed to be the same. So yeah, it lends itself to that too. So I know that there are a couple points I told you to keep in mind.
Okay.
So in researching this, I actually found a really, really, really good article by Sarah Gailey.
Okay.
Called.
Who is a great writer by all my accounts. Yes.
Called Leave the Hook Hand Murderer Alone. And it is actually a really good kind of exploration on not just the urban legend itself, but kind of how the hook is a good example of horror's relationship to disability.
Okay.
And also,
now I see where this is going.
Yeah.
So, okay.
And also just kind of horror's relationship to a lot of things and how a lot of these urban legends, like whenever we start to peel back the layers of them and kind of really, really look at them on a microscopic level, are a lot of them are problematic. And I think we know that. But a lot of times whenever we're like, ooh, spooky, scary, we don't examine that. And I think we should do more of that. So like one of the examples that Sarah brings up is we're all familiar with the urban legend of the people taking a trip to Mexico. And they get a dog and they bring it back home and they take it to the vet and because it's got some sort of sickness. And it's like, you know, surprise, it's not a dog, it's a rat.
Yeah.
Well, like, it's like, okay, let's examine that. Like, how much of that is rooted in like white American xenophobia and fears of, you know, the Mexican culture crossing the border and becoming part of, you know, their world?
Yeah, that story always struck me. Even as a kid, as being sort of like, how do you not know what a dog looks like? You know, it's not like the dogs suddenly look different when because you're in a different country.
Well, and like a lot of it, like I remember being a kid and people, and I think like this is one that's actually in Scary Stories, and the illustration for this one, it is hairless.
Yes,
and there are hairless dogs. We have friends who have hairless dogs who have like Chinese Cresteds. You can say they look rat-like, but they do not.
They're little rat dogs.
They are little rat dogs, but it is still very, very, very easy to discern that it is a dog and not a rat. Mm-hmm. I do want to actually read a little bit from this article about why the legend is scary in the first place, because it actually kind of ties back to what's a little bit of what we were just talking about. And a lot of it is like, you know, kind of sexuality is always kind of, it adds a little bit of a visceral layer to any type of horror. So what Sarah says in this is, Teen sexuality in horror, as in the Hook Hand murder legend, serves several purposes. It reminds adults that teens live in bodies that can suffer. It reminds adults that teens can do things outside of the control and supervision of adults. It reminds teens that they live in bodies that can suffer, while also reminding them that they can go places and be independent. And naturally, teen sexuality in horror marries all of these concepts together by reminding teens that if they go places to do things independent of adult supervision, there will be danger.
Yeah.
I think it kind of puts it together very well.
No, it does. I think there's a lot of like fears that are confounded by that. Like, you're a teenager, be careful, listen to what all of your parents say, do everything correctly, or else.
Let's kind of dive a little bit deeper into why the hook in and of itself is problematic in nature. And you said you kind of knew where this was going.
Yeah.
So first point to kind of discuss about it is the quote unquote escaped murderer from a prison or mental institution. And we see this in a lot of the urban legends. Like whenever it's something, there's a danger, is that it always comes from, usually it's always, in versions that I've always heard, it's always been a mental institution. It's never really been a prison.
No. And like our whole episode about the Bunny Man,
mm-hmm.
the Virginia Bunny Man, it's the same thing. The story is always that he was escaped from a mental institution.
That didn't exist. That didn't actually exist.
Didn't actually exist.
At the time. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it reinforces stereotypes pertaining to mental illness. And it also kind of reinforces upholds the like carceral system. Like, prison is good. People like this need to be in prison.
We need to put them away forever. They're scary people because they're different than us. And this guy, not only is he quote unquote crazy and a quote unquote psychopath, which was a real diagnosis back in this era, he also has a hook hand. And isn't that horrific?
There you go. That's the other point, is the hook hand itself. Because in the illustrations, like in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, there's an illustration for this as well. And what is the image that comes to mind whenever you think about the hook?
The image that I think of personally is just a man in the long jacket with a hook for like a hand. I always think, I always think of I Know What You Did Last Summer, like that murderer who has a very specific look to him.
So it's almost always like some sort of like meat hook type thing.
Yes, like, it's a giant meat hook instead of an actual like aid that people use when they have lost a limb. That's always the way it's been depicted. It's never been a, hey, I have like a cool thing that allows me to grab things and use my limb properly.
So exactly. So if we kind of, in the world of this story, if this person was incarcerated, whether it be in a traditional prison or a mental health facility, would they be allowed to keep a prosthesis that was a meat hook? No, it would be a functioning, needed prosthetic.
Functioning, like, prosthetic. And some of them do have the, I don't know the proper terminology for this, but it does, like, look like it's got two kind of metal fingers that kind of snap together and do look curved, but they're curved because it's easier to grab things when you have a curve, not that it's easier to murder teenagers with a curved like metal prosthetic.
So by replacing it with something scary and grotesque, it reinforces those social fears of people with disabilities.
And absolutely.
And that's why whenever the versions, like, I would be interested to know more about the areas where the variations where it's replaced with a glove instead of the hook, kind of culturally how things are there, or like what the communities in those areas look like, that maybe kind of changed it a little bit.
Yeah. Because I have never heard the glove version ever.
So one more point regarding, you know, the hook being a functioning prosthesis. And this is again from the article. I really love the way that Sarah puts this. This story punishes the would-be killer by taking away the device that functions as his prosthetic hand. This is a punishment that's repeated often in media across genres. A disabled villain is separated from his adaptive device, and the audience is asked to view it as justice. I don't think we examine that enough.
I definitely don't think that that's something that comes up with enough frequency to talk about in a lot of ways. And I know I have seen cases recently where that has been talked about a lot in some things. And the one that comes to mind to me specifically, did you see the Falcon and Winter Soldier miniseries?
Yes.
Okay, so there is a sequence in that, and this is not really a big spoiler, but there are some Wakandans in it, and I'm gonna pronounce it wrong, but the Royal Guard, the Dormilaje.
Dormilaje, yeah.
Dormilaje, yeah. Dormilaje. They disable Bucky's arm when they're in a fight together. And the arm like fall, and he's just vaguely, he's annoyed by it, but it doesn't like stop him. And there was a big discourse online talking about like, well, you've taken away his like functional limb. What does that say? Is that something you can really use for humor? And kind of the conversation that surrounded it. And I read a lot about it, and I have to say, like, I'm not really equipped to weigh in on this debate at all, but I'm glad that there is kind of a conversation specifically. And like, you know, Bucky's not a villain or anything like that. Like, I say this as like the Bucky Barnes stan, but I did find it like interesting that we were having this conversation around things. And I say we, but not me. But I thought it was like an interesting thing to read all these different perspectives. But you're right that a lot of times, well, let's just face it, a lot of times villains are disabled in some way. And that leads to the quote unquote like grotesquerie of them in that sort of language. So that when you vanquish one, a lot of times part of that is removing those adaptive devices. And that is seen as a win for our conventionally attractive and wholly like able-bodied heroes.
It's kind of it's the physical representation of, a lot of villains being portrayed as queer in some way, and that being like again, them being defeated as some sort of like justice because they're different and it's better that the world not have queer or disabled people.
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying yes as in I agree with you. I agree with
The
that that is a
point,
sen
yes, yeah.
sentiment that a lot of people like that people don't espouse it, but stories and the framing of certain narratives do suggest that sort of thing. So that's not something that I had thought about before now, but I find it very interesting to kind of bring up and discuss in that context.
Yeah, and definitely I'll link to this article in the show notes because there at the very end of the article, Sarah does a retelling of like, oh, here's a version of this that is updated modern from the modern world and also takes away a lot of the problematic elements too, and it's quite funny. So I would suggest
Okay.
everybody read it. There's also
Okay.
some good links in there to more discourse about horror's relationship with disabled individuals and disabled bodies.
Which is a very interesting topic, and I would love to have someone to come on and talk to about that that's more knowledgeable than me, 'cause yeah.
Yeah, after I read this, it kind of sparked that in me too. So I definitely think that, be on listeners, be on the lookout for that because it is, I think it is very much worth exploring.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with a lot of the urban legends, like especially whenever I talk about them, I want to talk about the impact to popular culture. I don't think I need to do that with the hook. I think that we understand enough. Like you brought up, I know what you did last summer. That definitely had an impact on the way that that killer looked. The one thing I will say, because I know it is something that you absolutely love, is that there is a Supernatural episode for this.
There's always a Supernatural episode. I haven't seen it.
Season
Once
one.
again, to reiterate, I've seen one episode of Supernatural, just one. It's the first one. That's it. Haven't seen any other ones. I just like to remind people that like I have no idea what you're talking about.
It
I
is
know
for
there's
those
an
who are
angel
curious. Yeah.
and some brothers. That's it.
For those who are curious, it is season one, episode seven, Hookman,
Okay.
where the legend does turn out to be real.
Spooky stuff.
Spooky stuff. Spooky stuff.
But I think a lot of what you're saying is that if, like, kind of to tie this, our discussion kind of together, is that most of these stories tie back to what most urban legends are about, which are moral panics in
Yeah.
some way or another. You have the moral panic against promiscuity, which is the big one, and the moral panic against any sort of like doing anything differently. after any period of time, because I think the like with in terms of like the kind of the Tinder date nightmare sort of scenario, it comes from this new fears about online dating, as opposed to the old fears about car culture dating. They can kind of like all tie in together there. It's same old stuff, just vaguely repackaged for a different era.
Yeah, I mean, because I think like Scream is a good example, because Scream, I kind of feel like the original from the 90s is a kind of a good bridge between kind of more classic horror tropes and then more like modern meta horror type stuff. And like they go into the rules of sort of like of being in a horror movie, and one of them is don't have sex.
Don't
Just
have sex or
don't.
you die. Yeah.
You die.
And that's really the kind of the core of a lot of the urban legends we've talked about is, don't have sex or you'll die. Or the youth are very scary when they're having sex. So that's the other kind of,
That part I think is kind of true though. As being a former youth, that part is kind
I
of
mean,
true.
yeah, as a former youth myself, like I will say to any youth listening to that, just, be safe. Just be safe.
Be safe, have fun.
Yeah, just be safe. Like that's
Exercise
it. Like,
consent, you know, all of that.
all that good stuff.
All that good stuff. Speaking of the youths, I asked again, you know, I do have teenagers in my life that I can
Yes, you
use
do.
as sources of information for things that we do not lo we no longer know about. And I was curious if, because of course we can do all the research that we want, but I was curious if there was actually anything real world example of something like The Hook or any of these Lover's Lane urban legends in modern culture. And I was like, yeah, do you have anything like that? And what I was told back, and I quote, "We're Gen Z. We don't have any imagination left in us."
That's the saddest thing that I've ever heard. Come on, Gen Z. I know you have imagination.
Yeah, but
But it's true in
it's
a lot of
true.
ways that it's a lot harder to find this sort of material. I can find misinformation every day of the week. But some of these stories that I would really be curious to hear about, and what are they in Gen Z? What is Gen Z saying about these things? Because I am most certainly not Gen Z, but I want to know, and I can't find anything about it anywhere.
No, I tried. I tried to see if I could find anything new, and then you know, I tried to ask a source and nothing. And I don't think it's a lack of imagination. I just think that the world we live in now, especially with just how connected we are, it discourages like the whole the friend of a friend trope kind of goes away when we're all connected and you can reach out to that friend of a friend to verify if
Right.
something is real or not.
I don't know though, because I see a lot of things being posted that seem to be vague, almost pseudo urban legends about some of these things that I've seen copies of, but I don't know that they're anything new.
They're not anything new, and I would venture to say that they're probably being posted by people who are our age or older.
That is a possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you know any Gen Z urban legends, let us hear them because I would love to find someone to talk to about this.
Yeah, it kind of like we have creepypastas and it falls off after that. Like we need to know what comes next. Please, somebody tell us what comes next.
What's after Backrooms? Like, that's what I would like to know.
What is after Backrooms? I
Yeah.
think that's also worth exploring at some point too, is that like I think TikTok has created a world of horror and supernatural stuff that I feel like is maybe like the next evolution of the creepypasta.
Yeah, and I'm all for it. As someone who grew up on creepypasta, I would love to see what's next.
Yeah, be on the lookout for those episodes. They are a coming, listeners.
Oh yeah, I have so much research.
I bet you do. I can't wait. I genuinely cannot wait. I don't know a whole lot about creepypastas myself, so I'm excited to have you educate me fully on those. But yeah, if listeners, if there is anything that you are aware of, any urban legends that are kind of not even just Gen Z ones, but that are tied to these that you think are interesting, please send that information our way. Also, if you are listening to us on Spotify, We are going to start incorporating more kind of questions that you can answer on there that we would like to use in future episodes, kind of your answers to those questions. So be on the lookout for that. And as always, rate and review. It helps.
Stay safe. Stay spooky.
Stay safe. Stay spooky. I think that's a good place to leave it.
Culture Cryptids is recorded, produced, and engineered by me, JD.
And me, Corey. You can find us on social media at Culture Cryptids on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Questions, comments, corrections, hate mail? Email us at culturecryptids@gmail.com. We'll see you next time. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Knox Pride.